Hello and welcome to the Etonicast. As always, I'm Alex Roy, here with the brilliant Kirsten Korosek from TechCrunch. Kirsten?
Hello.
And the amazing and fun Edward Niedermeyer. Edward.
This is the first time I've ever been called fun. Hey, Alex.
All right, let's dive right in here. Oliver Cameron, thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me. This is my favorite podcast, so I'm extremely privileged to be here.
Let's skip the formalities. I've had a story in the pipeline for months. There is no race for self-driving. There is a war. It's like Afghanistan. This is why. And the story is basically about May Mobility and you. Because every time I see a story, there's a chart with manufacturers and self-driving companies and how and when they're going to deploy. It never includes Voyage. And yet, if there is a race, I don't think there is, but if there even is a race, clearly you have flown under the radar and nailed this. Explain what you're doing in the villages in Florida.
For sure. So we are launching fully autonomous ride sharing at the villages. The villages is a very unique place. I don't think a lot of perhaps your listeners and the world has heard just enough about the villages. This amazing place with 125,000 residents on 750 miles of roadway. Now, what makes this place particularly special is that all of these folks are senior citizens. The average age is close to 70 years old, and these folks live in this massive, effectively retirement city in Central Florida. It has three separate downtowns. It has movie theaters, grocery stores, community centers, gyms, all that fun stuff. But what really makes it special for us specifically is that this city is really simplified. It's slower, it's less chaotic, it's got real transportation need from these residents. We hear these stories from these people every single day about how they feel comfortable driving in the daytime, but they feel really uncomfortable driving in the evenings. We all take for granted that we can grip a steering wheel for extended periods of time and can, you know, keep our reflexes high and make sure that we can react to crazy situations. When you talk to a senior citizen, those are the things that they worry about every single day. And what makes it even perhaps more special for us is that the amount of transportation options in this region is really limited. As you can imagine, the ride-sharing services, Lyft, Uber, rely upon this high density of driver supply that exists in a region. Well, the average 70-year-old doesn't want to be an Uber driver, right? So they don't tend to have even ride sharing as we know it today in this mess.
Can I stop you right there? Just so we're absolutely clear. You basically said, well, if you want to deploy, what is the simplest possible iteration of deploying level four in the villages is inherently geofenced. Target audience is prime for this use case. But it's the hinge of this is that, right, you have an exclusive with the villages to deploy level four. Is that correct?
That is correct. That is exactly correct. We have a multi-year agreement with the villages that no other autonomous vehicle company can just waltz on in and access their private villages and take residents point A to point B.
I'm really curious where, because this all makes so much sense. And we've been talking more and more about how, you know, finding the right place to deploy is so critical. And as Alex says, you guys have really hit on a unique and cool opportunity to do this. Mm-hmm. Where did the original idea for Voyage, for deploying in a, like, where were you? What were you doing? Like, what made you, or was it someone else? Like, where did this idea come from in the first place? And then we can go from there.
That's a good question. So the concise answer is that the idea came from Sebastian Thrun. So if anyone's familiar with self-driving cars, they'll know and have heard of Sebastian Thrun, overall robotics legend, founder of the Google self-driving car project way back when, winner of the DARPA challenges in 2005, 2007 with Team Stanford, and just in general, entrepreneurial, awesome person. So I spent 4 years at Udacity, and at Udacity did many things, including leading our machine learning curriculum, robotics curriculum, and eventually the self-driving car curriculum. We taught tens of thousands of people around the world how to build this technology. And what we did on the side was basically build this self-driving car because, hey, if we can't build a self-driving car ourselves, why the hell are we teaching this stuff to all these people around the world? And we started doing this and very short time went by where we felt, wow, we kind of surprised ourselves with how fast we can move and how impressive this car felt. We didn't talk about retirement communities then. We didn't even know, frankly, about retirement communities. We were focused on El Camino Real here in from Mountain View to San Francisco. And then I kind of, you know, got the itch, and a few of the other folks that were working with me on the program at Udacity got the itch as well to go start a new company. And we said, okay, let's go build self-driving cars. And we talked to Sebastian about this because he's the founder of Udacity. And he told me all about retirement commuters. Turned out in the very early Google days, they'd had debates about where to take their technology, where to begin deployments, where to test the vehicles, all that stuff. And he told me about a place in San Jose called The Villages. Now, it's very confusing because The Villages is a very common name between retirement commuters. It's not any sort of official participation or affiliation. But we went to see The Villages. We went to see a community in LA called Laguna Woods. Mm-hmm. And we visited a few others in and around the region. And he told me all about the time of the early Google days that he had this kind of contentious debate about retirement commuters, places like military bases in the US, for example, and of course, Public Street, Mountain View, et cetera. And it turned out that the consensus at Google at the time was, of course, we've got to, you know, we're Google, right? We're worth billions of dollars, retirement commuters, probably we might get laughed at. But he always kept that in the back of his mind. And this was, I think, 2009. So he sent one email to one of the board members at The Village of San Jose, said, I want to come talk to you guys, and I'll bring these folks from this self-driving car program. And we went to go see this place. And the really interesting thing for me, honestly, is as soon as you step in and into the gate of The Villages and walk through, it's a different world. It's the way I've likened it is if you listen to a podcast on 0.5x, things just feel so slow. And it's awesome because it's just a much more relaxed way of life. And as soon as we entered, I just knew that this was exactly the type of place we should be deploying because, again, not just the simple environment, but the pain points that we'd heard from those residents. So that's kind of how it all came to be. The Villages Florida was a very different negotiation, let's say. It took a lot longer because the place is much bigger, much more established. Of course, there's perhaps more risk there just because of the size of the population and whatnot that we have to really talk about, but that's kind of how we came to be at least focused on retirement commuters in the early days.
When you first walked through the gates, as you put it, at The Villages in San Jose, at that point, did you ever consider any other case for our deployment possibility? Or did you at that point go all in terms of knowing that the retirement communities were the best way to deploy?
Yeah, so we did explore other, let's call it constrained communities. I think the thing to know about retirement communities is that they are simpler, yes. There's still, you know, there's a spectrum, right? There's like empty parking lot on the far left, and then there's downtown San Francisco on the far right. It's not that, you know, retirement communities are so far to the left that they're just really easily solvable. So we actually start to look at even simpler places. So for example, looking at university campuses, looking at single routes, looking at airports, things like that. And we kind of came to the conclusion that our DNA as a company was one of a product company. We didn't want to sell, you know, 10 vehicles to some corporate entity that would, you know, put these to work and we'd never really get to meet the passenger. And the passenger maybe didn't even care that they were in an autonomous vehicle. They were just trying to go about their day and get, you know, from point A to point B at their job. And we really loved the angle that this was helping, you know, real people do something. Like just yesterday, I got an email from a 96-year-old World War II veteran, and I've been talking to him today. And it's just you hear the stories and you hear the pain points, and it's really hard for us as mostly able-bodied people to relate to the kind of struggles that they feel on a day, you know, daily basis. So all of that stuff really resonated, and it became clear that that was the right place. But we did explore different, you know, sorts of deployments, and still do, honestly.
So who did you call, and what happened in that first call, in that first meeting with The Villages?
It's a slightly embarrassing story, because I think when people think of, you know, they read about The Villages and they read about maybe Voyage and whatnot, they think there's some, like, you know, genius, unique insight that we had that we, you know, massively, you know, like light bulbs went on above our heads and whatnot. But the truth is, for the Villages Florida, I literally Googled these words, largest retirement community in the USA, and up popped the Villages. And at that point, you know, we just did more research on the place. We learned about pain points. We learned about the size, the roadways. We looked at Google Street View. And I sent a whole bunch of emails to the founding family. It's called the Moss family. It's a multi-generation business. They did just under $1 billion in revenue last year, and it's still entirely family owned. It's an amazing example of how to build a city where people are loving their lives in it. But emailed and then just got nothing back, absolutely nothing. I couldn't understand why, because we'd, you know, talked to all these other retirement communities. It seemed like they were super excited about this self-driving car thing. So eventually I went on a forum, and it was a forum for residents of the Villages. And I noticed that there was, you know, as any location has, you know, a few complaints here or there about certain things that were happening in the community. And someone had posted the phone number of one of the leadership team at the Villages. So I cold called this guy, who shall remain nameless for now, but cold called this guy. And just kind of introduced myself over the phone. I was like, at the very end, hey, did you guys get my emails? Can we talk about a deployment? He's like, oh yeah, sure. He's like, can you come meet next week? And of course, I was in California at the time, so I got on a plane. I went to go present in front of a whole bunch of people at the Villages. We brought our car out. We showed them videos of our work and our technology. And then I think it was like 3 or 4 weeks later, we had an agreement signed with the exclusivity that we've talked about, but also the Villages getting an advisory equity stake in Voyage, meaning that they share in the upside. Because if we win, then, you know, it's in large part thanks to the places that we're deploying in. And at that point, we were kind of golden, and we've been spending all that time since testing our vehicles, mapping the place, QA, generating miles, all that stuff. And we're launching a passenger service in the next few weeks. Our fleet is infinitely smaller than Waymo's, but it's going to be an impactful service nonetheless.
I have to say, I love that story so much, because in my experience, like, the best things in life, like, no one is smart enough to really, like, even identify them in advance. You kind of have to, like, luck into a lot of things. And I feel like the internet a lot of times allows that to happen more than maybe it did, you know, pre-internet. And so I just, like, that story is really cool. Anyway, go on.
Typical millennial statement. Anyway, the internet solves all things. Now, actually, it was a great story. I was just curious, what is my understanding of the Villages in Florida is that it actually is over at least one or two counties or a couple of different municipalities. And what is the regulatory structure there? I mean, who are you accountable to? Is it sort of like an HOA? Is there a mayor? What is that like there?
Yeah, so this is somewhat complex answer. So just as a quick stat, the Villages, like I said, there's 125,000 residents. They have more land that they own to build on than they've already built on. So they're going to be expanding rapidly, and it'll probably be in multiple, you know, counties and whatnot. So it's going to keep on growing. So the way to think about this is that there's a big distinction between public and private. So on public road, of which there is a mixture in the Villages of public road, of course, that, you know, goes all the way through like an artery of the community, as it were, that is regulated by the state of Florida. They have a whole bunch of autonomous vehicle legislation that's been led by an amazing state senator, Jeff Brandes.
We know Jeff.
Friend of the show, yeah.
He's been doing this since before it was cool, right? He has been putting his AV out there to help companies like ours for the longest time. So the state of Florida in general is quite permissive when it comes to testing. So you don't need permits per se. You need insurance, which of course we have lots of, but you don't need necessarily to pass a test or submit for a permit or submit yearly reports like the California DMV kind of stipulates. But then there is these private roadways. So as soon as you go into the villages, you'll notice there's a lot of obviously villages. That's why it's called the villages. Each one has its own unique kind of spin on how you live. And each one of these has gates. These gates have card readers, and this land is private land. So to do anything on that land is governed by the villages. And effectively, we don't have anything that, again, it kind of just mirrors what Florida has done itself. We just kind of self-certify, as it were. And that comes with great responsibility. We want to make sure that we're sharing continuous flow of information about the state of our vehicles, our team, and all that sort of stuff. So that's kind of how it works. There's private, public. Private is the villages. We share lots of information with them all the time. Public is the state of Florida. Very permissive, very awesome. We're happy to call that home.
So you mentioned that there's sort of a spectrum of challenges or like challenging domains where you could operate or test or validate an autonomous vehicle. And you also kind of said that like this is not the hardest. I'm sorry, it's clearly not the hardest, but it's also not the easiest, right? It's not like an empty lot somewhere with absolutely zero traffic. It's also not fixed route, right? So you have some dynamic issues going on there too. So I'm curious, like what are the things about the villages that actually make it harder than, you know, other places? Like what are the unique challenges of operating a vehicle there?
Yeah. So the way I would think about this is that there are areas where you can rely upon zero pedestrians being present, right? So, or at least being heavily, heavily controlled, that it'd be super bizarre that you'd see a pedestrian. Things like maybe construction sites. There's areas where if you kind of, you know, cordoned off a route for an autonomous truck or autonomous whatever, that you could rely that no humans would step in the way. Things like airports, perhaps, again, highly structured environments and whatnot. But as soon as you introduce pedestrians to the mix, things get much harder, right? Because you've got suddenly all these different variables of which they're moving in all different directions, can jump out in the vehicle. And of course, it's the most risky thing to be in and around. So that's kind of where the step up I find is from the most constrained environments. And then also, it's not acceptable to go 5 miles an hour, right? So you've seen some of the shuttle services really focus on like 5-ish mile an hour travel. And if you tried to do that in this place, you would get run off the road. There'd be some very angry drivers behind you. So when you put in speed and you put in pedestrian complexity, you get certain amounts of challenges to solve. But again, I think what's really important is to think about the things that they don't have. So the way the villages came to be is that it's the largest master plan community in the US for sure, maybe on the planet, I don't know. And what that means is that the whole place was planned, of course, up front. So they had real thought about how pedestrians and vehicles would meet and ensured that if the two were to meet, meaning pedestrians on the side of the road next to vehicles, that the speed limits were much lower. One really great concrete example of this is that they, of course, want to encourage their residents to go on bicycles, they want to go jogging, they want to go on even scooters, all that sort of stuff. But you've probably observed that bike lanes in our cities are quite dangerous places to be because you've got cars merging over, you've got lots of crazy things happening. So they actually built entirely separate, concrete divided pathway for bikes, for joggers, for golf carts, for NEVs that does not touch the roadway. So you've got all these factors which help control some of the more complex factors that you see, the primary one being speed. But you've still got some of that complexity because you still have factors like pedestrians and whatnot. You don't see traffic lights too often in the villages. Very rare and definitely avoidable if you needed to avoid it. They prefer to see things like roundabouts and intersections and such to kind of move traffic around. The roadways are wider. The roadways, again, are slower. So it's definitely in the middle of that spectrum of simplicity.
I was wondering about the golf cart situation there. Is that the one of the more complicated objects, I guess, that you have to, or obstacles that you have to deal with? Because I've heard that there's quite a lot of golf cart action going on in the villages.
To make this even more of a leading question, I'm reading looking at a story right now that is about golf cart DUIs in the villages specifically. Yeah. So this seems like a unique challenge that maybe other companies aren't having to deal with.
So we definitely have to be aware of them, and I hope this answer might be too technical, but to preface, they are very aware that there's a mixture of golf carts and cars on the road. And that, of course, in any sort of traffic accident, the golf cart with a car is going to lose, right? You've got a 3-ton whatever SUV. You've got maybe a 750-pound, 500-pound golf cart or whatever. You're not going to fare too well in those things. So again, they really try to avoid those two things really meeting in any significant way. If you're in a golf cart, you are in a golf cart lane, or you are in a concrete divided golf cart lane, hopefully far away from any traffic. But that said, it's a great point because you see chaos, right? Things are going to happen. People are going to be driving like they shouldn't be driving. So where we've spent a whole bunch of time from a technology perspective is on the art of prediction. So if you were to go in any sort of demo self-driving car, just any rando startup that decides to go fundraising and wants to build a self-driving car, they'll focus on a single route. They'll focus on a series of things which they've tested before, and they know for that specific route, it really works very well. But when you try and put that thing in different routes, you try and put that car in different environments, different traffic patterns, different intersections, all that stuff, it really falls apart very quickly. So what we have been spending a whole bunch of time on since we founded the company is on, like I said, the art of prediction. You've got perception, which perceives the world. It tells you all of these objects around it. And of course, we have these really high resolution LIDARs that tell us just how far away objects are, the velocity of those objects, things like that. But what we don't get from pure perception is prediction. So what we then do is say, for any of these actors that are in and around us, can we predict what they're going to do next? Using both behavioral models, kinematic models, can we actually say, in a few seconds time, where will this thing end up being? And then what we do is basically look all around us in 360 degrees and come up with a hypothesis using all these different predictions we've generated, which of course we take golf carts into consideration when generating those predictions. How should our car act in that 100 millisecond loop? Should our car gently hit on the brake? Should our car accelerate? Should our car veer towards the right of the lane because someone's going to merge into our lane from the left? So when it comes to golf carts, we bake in their behaviors specifically into our stack. I'm pretty sure we're the only self-driving car company that classified golf carts. and I think we have like 150,000 unique golf carts labeled. It's an immense amount. Maybe that's a little too much, but it's we can definitely detect and track golf carts and predict what they're going to do. So that's a very long answer, but we very much look to predict what any object is doing, frankly, but golf carts specifically are obviously very important because they're at a disadvantage when it comes to any big car. So, but we definitely see them all the time. I actually think golf carts for us are more of a challenge from an adoption perspective. So not to ramble on too much, but one of our beliefs is that this location, the villages, will actually be one of the first that sees significant switching from personal car ownership to summoning of vehicles. So I think the reason we think this is because, again, the pain points are real. People, even though they own cars, don't necessarily want to own cars. There's definitely some there that do, and they'll keep those, and that'll be great. But there's a significant population that just have a car because it's the only way they can get around. So we think that this location is going to be one of the very first that is willing to give up car ownership because of the demographic, because of the pain points and transitions to a ride-sharing service.
So in order to deploy, did you have to install any infrastructure?
So not necessarily. So there's a big caveat here that so I think what you're talking about is, things like cameras on streetlights and
anything.
Yeah. So we do have something. We haven't talked about it yet. And I probably shouldn't talk about it because I'll get shouted at. But it's not.
Yes, you should talk about it. You should talk about it.
Think about how wireless networks like 4G and LTE when you use your iPhone or whatever are really not mission critical, right? I try and load Facebook and it dies because I'm slightly in the wrong location. And you've probably seen a few companies try and do teleoperation using that network. And it's different forms of teleoperation. It's not always live driving, it's remote commanding and things like that. But what we think is that because we have the official participation of this region, that we can actually have a mission critical, reliable network that we are the only customer of. And that does require some installation, but it's a little different than you'd think. It's not necessarily like 5G or like cell towers or anything like that.
So we're clear. So it's there is some limited proprietary infrastructure that you've deployed specific to your deployment that if your multi-year contract with the villages ran out, no one else could use it if they marched in and got a contract to replace yours.
That is correct. But the infrastructure we're installing is kind of it's
lightweight.
It's hidden from IV. Like you wouldn't see it as you're driving through. It's not like a camera on a street light. It's if you think about cell towers, which there's numerous towers in the villages, think about leasing space on those towers to install some equipment that we use for this application. But of course safety is absolutely critical. So everything you can do without excuse to, you know, make your vehicle as safe as humanly possible, even if it means installing your own networks into this region. We see that as our kind of responsibility to do that, even if it costs a big chunk of cash or a fair chunk of cash.
Well, I was just curious what, as you scale up here and then you look to repeat this, I would assume as you're able to in other communities, what, when you're talking about the capital investment for this type of infrastructure, what are we talking about? And, you know, if you're looking at it costs X to set up in a place like villages, what type of, what percentage, if you can't share a number, would go to establishing this network, for example?
Yeah. So this is why I think there's a good delineation to make between like cameras on streetlights and things like this, because in theory, a camera on a streetlight means that, you know, you're going to require hundreds of thousands, maybe one day of these devices operating. And then you have maintenance cost of all these different things, and you have to go work with the city in order to get them done because it's such a volume. So I think of this as a, in a place as large as the villages, it's 750 miles of road, 40 square miles of land. We'll probably need less than 10 installations in this region to cover the whole thing, and probably being conservative. In terms of the cost, I probably shouldn't share it just yet, but it's not as crazy as
share it. You should share it.
It's okay. There are more interesting things.
I love how the deal works. The peer pressure is there, but it's, if you actually look at some of the pictures of our vehicles, you'll probably over time have seen, if you look quite closely, just different things that we try on top of the vehicle that are not LiDARs, they're not cameras, they're not radars. And you'll start to discern from that. But yeah, I think it's not as crazy as it looks. And the aim is that, you know, there's only a handful of these things in any given deployment. And that, who knows, the mythical 5G may negate the need for any of this stuff. But at least today, we think having that network, this mission critical, secure network is very important, and it's not as crazy from a cost perspective. Maybe I'll follow up after with some breakdown, but it's not that crazy.
Okay.
Yeah. What is, so I mean, I've tweeted about how amazing I think it is. Like the way you were able to find this deployment scenario is really cool and was really forward looking. I'm wondering though, like, what is your business model? Because I know that right, the villages has an equity stake in you. Are they providing your revenue? Is it coming from the people getting the rides? Like, what does it look like? And maybe even like, where is it going?
Yeah, so this is what we think is a pretty big differentiation between us and some of the others in our kind of category, other companies. We very much made the decision early that we don't see a huge opportunity to take revenue from cities and places like that, kind of the enterprise model, right? Where you take, you know, a few million dollars to run a service, and you have SLA service level agreements, and you make sure that you hit those and whatnot. What we decided to do is say that the Villages to us has 125,000 potential customers, right? So what's the fastest, most efficient way, and thus as a business, the largest opportunity to get to those people? And how do we then have defensibility? Well, first step is yes, let's make sure we have exclusivity. Let's make sure we're not in a race to the bottom with, you know, five other autonomous vehicle companies in San Francisco. And then secondly, it's to say that we want to have co-marketing arrangements with the Villages. So we want access to your residents, meaning we want to work with you on your, believe it or not, TV stations, radio stations, thriving newspaper. There's a great New York Times article about the Villager newspaper, which is the last thriving newspaper in America. It's absolutely crazy. 90,000 paid subscribers and growing very, very fast, very high readership. Now, how can we work with them, places like that, to get the word out about Voyage? But then effectively, we just, you know, very similar to Uber, go straight to the consumer. And then if we do a great job of delivering a service, we'll get repeat usage and we'll get repeat revenue and we'll grow and word of mouth will spread. My feeling was that if we went to the Villages in the beginning and asked for, you know, a few million dollars to cover transportation costs and whatnot, they would have probably paid it, but we'd have probably been, you know, fairly limited in the room for moving that up one day. We think the Villages could be, you know, a $7,500 million annual recurring revenue business for us. Wow. Because of the mass of people that exist there and all the problems that we think we can help solve. So that's kind of how we think about it, that the larger opportunity, albeit the harder one to get to, is to go direct to consumer. We kind of avoided the whole enterprise-y sort of route. But time will tell which is the right approach.
Are you charging for rides right now?
Yeah, that's how much? What does it cost?
So today, and this is kind of the trade-off, right? So we offer free rides. The impact of that is that we get learnings. We understand what they're looking in a service like ours, the places they'd like to go, things like that. We hear stories that, you know, we tailor our service to. One of those examples was that in a Chrysler Pacifica, even though it is one of the more accessible vehicles, it has, I believe it's the most common converted wheelchair accessibility in the kind of minivan category. Even though it has all those features, getting in and out of the Chrysler Pacifica is a nightmare. It's kind of weird. You have to do this weird dance when you jump in and kind of wriggle around the seat and then get to the back. So we actually just said, screw it, let's just remove one of the seats. We removed the seat from the passenger door opening so that there's a whole bunch of room now when you are trying to get in to kind of get comfortable and maneuver to go to which seat. We learned that from these particular passengers. Yes, the intent is that 2019 for us is the year of revenue. And the 2018 has been a year of technology development and QA and testing and miles and all that sort of stuff.
How far is the nearest international airport, or I guess airport that Villages residents may want to go to?
So actually, we get this request all the time. So the Orlando MCO is, I think it's about 60 miles away. So, you know, hour and a bit of driving. That's a very common request. Also, Walt Disney World is a very common request. Of course, that involves a lot of different driving, but it's not in the middle of absolute nowhere. There is, you know, a bunch of stuff around it.
So if someone wants to go to the airport, you just say no, wait 5 years? I mean, what is the, like, what's the plan?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the kind of unfortunate reality of AV today, like you mentioned, is that there are certain categories of transportation that we just, focus for our 40-odd person engineering team, just cannot tackle, highway driving, you know, being one of those. And that we would say that the trade-off is that we'll get to driverless sooner in a more constrained set of circumstances and iterate after that on things like highway driving and whatnot. So it's effectively, like you said, honestly, it's like, you want to go to the airport? I'd love to. I really would. Today, we can't do that. There are a host of other services that do serve that that need, the long distance kind of shuttles and whatnot from back and forth. but the inner community transportation is where the pain points are traditionally felt. But no, I agree. It sucks that we can't do it. And I would much rather we be able to serve those people.
Do you see a scenario then, even though you have exclusivity, but let's say you really focus all of your attention within the confines of the villages, which is huge. But another company that, let's say, makes some progress on their tech, on highway driving, is actually starts a business specifically for these like sort of long distance drives. So out to the airport and back. Do you ever see a scenario where you would partner with some companies like this? Or do you want to kind of own the whole space in how these folks get around, even if there is a limitation to it now to going to the airport?
Yeah. So I think one thing that's worth noting about us specifically is that we are very partner friendly. What that means for us today is that we see a whole bunch of the autonomous stack as infrastructure problems that are best solved outside of our company. So for example, mapping, I think you guys very much know the awesome Roe and the Calmera team, simulation, teleoperation, middlewares, some of the safety systems. We think it's better to partner on some of those areas than it is to build internally, because we can focus again on the harder problems, perception, vehicle intelligence, all that stuff. So we've become quite good at partnering, honestly, which was not always the case, but today we are. I don't think it's that weird for us to think about partnering, you know, on a service basis with other companies. We did partner, albeit not the same exact thing, with Enterprise in order to do some pretty cool stuff with leasing of vehicles to become autonomous. We've done the same for insurance. I think the question, though, which I'm kind of dancing around, is that my gut answer is that we'd like to own the entire experience. Mm-hmm. Not because we're or anything, but just because the experience that I think we can deliver will be consistent, will be better, and will be something which I would love as a ambitious entrepreneur to own. But who knows? I think that's a big if there. But I think my gut reaction would be I'd love to own all that that side of the house. But a lot of it depends on timelines. If a company comes out of nowhere tomorrow and says we've got highway driving solved, then great, let's partner. If we're close to highway driving being solved in 2, 3, 4 years, then maybe not, because we're close.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense to want to have that, especially since it's all about relationships that you're establishing with these people over time. And so if you don't want a bad experience to then completely throw, associate, let's say, one bad experience with another company with all self-driving companies and suddenly, not trust your service as a result. So I could see the desire to do that. But of course, it all depends on how other companies develop their own tech and what happens.
Exactly. I totally agree. And I think there's also going to be collaborations with things like delivery companies and all that sort of stuff that are just a little too outside of our wheelhouse of, moving people. But who knows?
So it seems like one of the really exciting things about your company, I think, is that you're really well positioned to study and understand and potentially incorporate into a vehicle like accessibility considerations, right? Which it may not be a massive thing right now. I mean, it is. There are a lot of people who don't have access to, truly accessible vehicles. But so I'm wondering, like, are you as the sort of baby boomer generation ages, like that market's only going to grow. There's all kinds of disabled communities who struggle with accessible mobility. Is that something you're specifically looking at? And are you working towards maybe potentially developing your own vehicle? Obviously, I don't think you're going to get into manufacturing your own vehicle, but like, would you someday like to be able to work with an OEM to design a vehicle that's purpose made for the kind of circumstances that you operate in? Or is that too far down the road to even think about right now?
So two thoughts on this. So one is that somewhat candidly, I'm pretty inspired by the whole micromobility thing. I think it's actively suggesting that, cities are rejecting finally, 3-4 ton monstrosities that, are taking up precious space on our planet. And I think the form factors that, you know, we're seeing in kind of, let's call it sheltered micromobility with, you know, canvas covers and all that sort of stuff, where you have a seat, which is very useful. I think all of those are pretty inspiring. I don't think it's weird that, you know, the car that we might use after the Pacifica might not look very much like a car at all, bar a seat and bar the weird looking LiDAR stuff on top. So that's the first thing. The second thing I'd say is that specific to retirees, the kind of way we think about our company is that we go very deep into certain categories. So for example, kind of think of this like sub-brand, Voyage Retirement, right? And Voyage Retirement is all about delivering the world-class best way for a senior citizen to move. Today, that's in a retirement community. Maybe one day that's outside of retirement communities as well. I believe the stat is like 5% of senior citizens live in a retirement community today. It's 2,500 of them in the US, but there's a whole host of obviously more senior citizens out in the world that need better transportation services. So that's obviously meaning that if we were to do that and go really, really deep in this market, not just see it as a stepping stone, that you'd go heavily in the customized way, right? You think about how the vehicle should reflect the consumer base that you're targeting, and that the vehicle should be very accessible, not just like little bits and pieces like removing, you know, a driver's side, a passenger side seat, but wheelchair ramps, thinking about folks that are vision impaired, all that sort of stuff. So if you ask me today, that's kind of where we go. That's today it's retirement communities, and one day it's not such a technological problem to expand outside into, you know, cities and whatnot, but that there'll always be a product focus on a certain consumer that we think has a transportation pain point. I don't want to be just this generic ride sharing service that ends up in a weird price war with all the big guys that we, you know, end up not being in a great position for. I'd much rather really serve a massive population very well, but own that, you know, kind of service and own that experience and do an awesome job of the vehicle form factor and all that stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to punish you for your candor here, which I really, really appreciate, but like, it sounds like you're thinking about or possibly even working on a fully custom vehicle. Is that may not be a car at all?
So the way to think about this is we never build a vehicle in house.
Right.
We're software folks, right? We think from a software perspective, and we think about hardware integration for sure. But we think about that in a software context. The way I would say that we do this, if we were to do this, is we definitely partner. I think some of the most interesting experiments are not coming out of the OEMs, but are coming out of startups, honestly, and not ones that are in Silicon Valley. So I think what you'd see is we partner with that company, take their vehicle, do some work with them to enable what we, you know, need to enable, and then deploy those vehicles. It would definitely not be, you know, our own effort. I've always been inspired by Google's Firefly experiment, and I'm infinitely sad that died. I don't know how controversial that is to say on this show, or if that is even controversial, but I think when they were thinking about that product, they were thinking about all these things, and they were thinking about, you know, maxing at 25, and they were thinking about accessibility and what a true driverless experience might look like, and a more cost-effective driverless experience might look like as well. So lots of stuff there, but I wouldn't say we're building a vehicle for sure. That's almost never going to happen.
Right. Okay. And just one more follow-up on this, like, is so the Firefly, which by the way, I completely share your opinion on, but that was a low speed vehicle, right? Which is this regulatory category, that golf carts also fit into, and they don't need to pass crash test standards, but you also can't take them on a road where the speed limit's over like 35 miles per hour. Is that something that you would consider a low speed vehicle, or would a Voyage vehicle always have to be like fully within the standard, you know, highway capable regulatory category?
Yeah, so I think the thing that I would always optimize for is safety, right? So there's multiple ways to think about it, but I've always been a believer that golf carts, as they are today, are kind of the if we look at scooters, electric scooters today, and how kids' scooters that are obviously manual were kind of the precursor to it, I think golf carts today are kind of this precursor to what the car would look like. They look weird. They're kind of, you know, inefficient. You can't go everywhere in them. But they are really fun to drive, and they're actually fairly convenient just to jump in and out because they're really small and really nimble and all that sort of stuff. And you can go.
They're perfect height, actually, to get in and out, especially if you have arthritis or, you know, a lot of cars today, as you mentioned, you have to either jump in or it's super low. These are like, you just slide right in.
Exactly. But they come with some significant downsides, right? One is that they rarely, if ever, have airbags. There's very little crash protection, especially if you're sharing the road with real cars. Range has been an issue. They're not the most useful vehicles if you want to go travel quite frequently, all those things. But I think those are just challenges to be solved, and that those sorts of vehicles will be the more prevalent type of autonomous vehicle in future than giant cars. But that said, I think what you'll end up seeing is a company like ours has a fleet of different types of vehicles, right? You'll end up with a fleet of these much smaller, much more efficient, much slower vehicles. And that's maybe, you know, 75% of the fleet, because that's going to serve cities very well, like the villages. But then someone wants to go to the airport and they need to travel much faster, and range is perhaps an issue and all that sort of stuff. Well, you know, a minivan works great for that. Chrysler Pacifica going either city to city or city to airport or wherever it turns out to be. Those sorts of things work well. So that's kind of how I think about it today. I don't know how it'll quite pan out, but I think the Firefly suffered from being a little too early and suffered from the kind of notion that low speed equals low opportunity. And thus, you know, to solve self-driving on a scale of Google, they had to go to a Pacifica to travel everywhere. But I do wonder if that perhaps was just a little too early.
My understanding is that right now you still have human test drivers in the vehicles, and which would be a normal, appropriate thing during, you know, as you're ramping up. But I've seen photos. I think we were at an event where there was a presentation on Voyage, and all the photos I saw of the experience of Voyage was a human being like handing a rider a water bottle, or, you know, saying, opening the car door for them, or a very human element. So I'm wondering what is going to happen to Voyage, even if you technically master self-driving, you pull the human being out and it changes that experience.
The product will have to adapt to the use cases that it needs to solve. So the truth is, we as a, you know, company today are just very mission driven, right? So we'll inevitably go way above and beyond for the people that get in our car, and we'll, you know, almost make it a customer service function. I think what I've heard that Waymo has tried to do, which I think is perhaps the right way, is to say that those, you know, test drivers that are currently in the vehicles almost should be, and don't quote me on this as it were, but they should be a little cold, because they, you know, they're almost not there, right? Or they're trying to, you know, have the experience almost reflect that they aren't there by using other means to communicate with Waymo through, you know, the in-car audio thing they have and such. So I think there's this transition that's going to happen that's a little weird, that is going to take some time, that is going to be probably more surprising than we think it will be. The problems that, you know, we think are going to be the ones that we need to solve today are probably almost certainly not the ones that actually need solving. So it does keep me up at night to think about, you know, honestly, that a senior citizen who has mobility challenges today, you know, we hold their hand, we open the door, we get them in and sit them down and ask, you know, tell them all about a self-driving car. How will that experience be done when there isn't a human in the car? So the candid answer is I don't know exactly just yet how that transition will go, but I just got to think it's a worthwhile one. I think the benefit of autonomous vehicles will be that it finally becomes cost effective to summon a car that you don't drive, which again is maybe, you know, par for the course in San Francisco, where you can summon an Uber or whatever. But again, when you're talking about a retiree that doesn't feel confident driving in the evenings, that can now suddenly, you know, for a dollar or $1.50 a mile or whatever it ends up coming out to, you know, go travel to see a friend and feel that independence again, I just got to think that that's probably a better solution than currently exists.
Do you see a scenario where you could have a couple different pricing structures? So let's say someone needs extra assistance because of a mobility issue, or just because they would prefer to have conversation with a human being, where they pay a little bit more and there's a human being in the vehicle. Maybe they're not driving the car anymore, but they're there almost as like a concierge service. It's a little bit more luxe, a little bit more personal.
Yeah, no, it's not a weird concept. I think there's going to be certain rides where economically there would be room, and not to sound too business-like, but there would be enough room in the margin of the ride, the trip, to include a human, right? So let's say you've got a vehicle that is, you know, a Pacifica that has 5 passengers, something like that. Maybe the economics start to work where, you know, for a large group trip where there's lots of luggage or lots of things that they're carrying from a trip or whatever, it would be actually perhaps beneficial to have a human there, because that group of 5 people, if they get a great experience during that particular ride, will be more likely to use it on their own later. The retention rate of those people will be higher, perhaps, if they have those interactions from time to time with a human. So I don't think it's weird. I think obviously the industry tackles this as a technology problem today, which is remove the driver. But inevitably, removing the driver is just going to present a whole bunch of unintended potential opportunities that may include, as hilarious as this sounds, and certain trips putting a driver back in there, or at least in the back seat or other, you know, sort of functions. But yeah, who knows? I think it's definitely an interesting topic, though.
All of us at the Autonicast admire your approach, and that's rare that we all agree that the subject is universally doing something good. But assuming that you succeed, things go well, and I tweeted while as we recorded this episode that I predict a big exit for Voyage. Is it your wish that human driving be banned?
No, definitely not. Mm-hmm. And I swear I'm not saying that because you're here. Mm-hmm. I promise. I think ultimately it's options, right? I think the lens I've always viewed this with is that the technology we develop, that everyone develops, is going to have to deal with human drivers on the road. So it's being developed that way today. And I think it would be foolish to say in future that, human driving is banned. And I think, I don't see a future where that is something I would like. I think freedom to move, emergency situations, old cars, you want to make sure that those things are not outlawed.
So has there been any pushback or friction of any kind from any one of the villages about self-driving vehicles cruising around?
Oh yeah, no, definitely. So by and large, it's a very positive experience in terms of the feedback we hear. But we do, you know, we hear frustration, we hear fear of this technology. My own grandmother hates that I work on this. She thinks it's a waste of time and that, you know, she's fine driving, and we disagree on that. So, but we definitely, you know, we get feedback all the time. And again, it's very, very mostly very positive. But there is any AV startup company CEO would be totally lying if they said it was going to be a smooth transition. And for us, you know, what is our responsibility is that we have to convince these folks that this is a better technology, that this is safe. And hey, we may not get you as a customer, that's fine. But there's a whole bunch of people around you that want to use it, and that's great. And let's have you as a supporter of that instead of a detractor. We have some work to do there, but it's important work, I think.
Now, I know we're coming up on an hour. We need to wrap this up. I have one more question, guys. May I ask it?
I have one more too.
Maybe it's the question.
So you said that so you believe in coexistence with the human-driven vehicles. You believe in mobility options and people should have a choice to own a vehicle. You also said that you thought it was possible that people could replace private ownership within the villages with Voyage rides. There have been in recent years an increasing number of terrible hurricanes have struck Florida. So, were your own customers to replace their vehicles with Voyage rides, and one of these storms struck, is it your plan or hope your vehicles will be able to transport them to the edge of the villages and then what? Abandon them? What is the answer there?
You saved the hard question for last. I like it.
I like you enough to let you make your case, and I think you've made a strong case, but I have to ask this.
I'd love to have the perfect answer here. I think the tough thing here, right, is where to optimize for, right? Because if we optimize for the disaster scenario, which do happen, and they happen increasingly frequent, as we all see, and they are very impactful when they do happen, then yes, not much is probably going to change from today, albeit that we've all seen the imagery and satellite imagery of when, or helicopter imagery, when, you know, well, people are leaving disaster zones and there's just insane traffic that inevitably occurs and people are gridlocked and backed up and can't move, right? The ride-sharing aspect, of course, delivers a whole bunch of benefits today that in the 99.99% of the time when there isn't a disaster, provides a whole bunch of benefit. Not to kind of weasel my way out of this, but I don't have a super crystal clear answer that says if that happened and 90% of the villages is, you know, using our service and has given up car ownership, that we'd have, you know, 1,000 buses waiting, you know, to take those folks away. Perhaps that is the answer, but I don't have that as a crystal clear thing. But I do think it's important we not just talk about those things, but actively prepare for those sorts of inevitabilities going to happen. So let's make sure that we're not ignoring it, because that would be a hard lesson to learn.
Well, there's an important thing here, though, that at least put the villages in a slightly different category than this question that Alex loves to ask. How many people, or what are the percentage of people who live in the villages right now that own vehicles? Do virtually all of them own vehicles, or is there a percentage of the population there that don't have vehicles?
It is almost all. So I don't have the exact number on the top of my head, but it's basically 100%.
Okay.
And the way I see this is that the reason that is the case is because there just isn't anything better. Like, personal car ownership there is just the only way to get about. And this place is not particularly dense. So, you know, going to a Best Buy, going to see a friend, going to a downtown, going to a restaurant is a fairly lengthy trip. So to take a bus or to call, so for example, the only taxi service that operates in the place is a 48-hour book in advance taxi service. So think about that experience, you know, 15 years ago, whenever it was. We all forget about now.
I was attempting to rescue you. Yeah, I was attempting to rescue you in your answer, because if you had said there isn't, there's a certain percentage of people who don't have cars. But I will say this, is that maybe not in the case of the villages or other upscale communities, but in middle class, lower middle class, or some urban dense communities, the elderly. And I have some sort of personal connection to this because I've mentioned this on the show before, I'm on the board of directors of a all-volunteer nonprofit that helps elderly people in the neighborhood that I live in provide free transportation and keep them socially out of social isolation. None of these people drive, and none of them have cars. And so there is a percentage of the population that exists already. Whether they're not in the villages is probably not the case, but they certainly exist in throughout Florida and other places where there are hurricanes, where they don't have access to cars at this point anyway. Whether they're autonomously driven or human driven, they just either can't drive because of a physical issue, or they don't have the means to own a vehicle. So I don't know if the autonomous vehicle question, Alex, that you ask, it is a really good point. But at the same time, there are already lots of people who don't have access to a car right now at all.
So it goes. We got to wrap this up, guys. Well, thank you so much for coming.
Thanks, Oliver, for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, if people want to find out more about Voyage or like follow you guys' developments, I know you just have a post out today. It'll be up. Sort of, it'll been out for a week by the time this episode airs. But it sort of tells a little bit of the story of why retirement communities are perfect for self-driving cars. But why don't you just tell folks like where people can read stuff like that or follow you or follow the company?
So we don't have a great domain. We don't have voyage.com, but check out voyage.auto, A-U-T-O. Follow me on Twitter @OliverCameron. And I love email. So oliver@voyage.auto. I'd love to hear thoughts. And if you're interested in jumping into the field, I'd love to talk to you.
Did you just say you love emails?
I don't know why I said that. I love emails from people that are excited about self-driving cars or from residents.
Okay. Good clarification.
Cool. Well, thank you so much, Oliver, for making the time. This has been really fascinating. And like Alex said, it is actually really rare for all three of us to be like universally jazzed about a company. We kind of like to fight about stuff, and it's kind of weird that like there's nothing about what Voyage does that like we can really fight about. So I think that's a great sign, and certainly wish you all the luck.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. We will need it. I appreciate the show having me on here. It's been a great bunch of fun.